Greetings and welcome to What's Wrong with Wolfie. My name is Jason.
And I'm Chris.
And I'm Cliff.
And we're really sorry, but we're talking about Batman and Robin. As mentioned on part one of the movies of 1997, it was an incredible year for films, but there is one that sticks out like a sore thumb. It showed a ton of potential from its director Joel Schumacher and its cast, including George Clooney, Uma Thurman and Arnie, and set this film high on many people's most anticipated film lists. But when it was released, it was slammed by critics and received a dismal box office return. Was it because it was the first film in the series to not have any involvement from Tim Burton, or was it just shoddy writing? 25 years after release, we decided to go back and rewatch Batman and Robin with fresh eyes to see if it really deserved that slamming, whether 4K has helped make it a wonder to behold, or were we all a bit harsh on Clooney and Co., the film that some people label the worst film ever made and caused Warner Bros. To cancel all future movies in the franchise for 8 years, and the film which is the lowest grossing live-action Batman film to date. It is, of course, Batman and Robin.
I want a car. Chicks dig the car.
This is why Superman works alone.
Critics are calling it the best Batman ever.
Yeah!
Schwarzenegger and Thurman are the best summer villains on the big screen. George Clooney, Chris O'Donnell, and Alicia Silverstone make a great action-packed trio. The event of the summer is here. Batman and Robin, rated PG-13. Now playing at a theater near you.
To help us on what might be a tough journey, we are joined by two guests. The first, as you heard from the intro, is replacing Rich, as he unfortunately couldn't make it this time. So please welcome from the N64 Life podcast, the amazing Cliff.
Yay, Batman and Robin.
Boo! Brill.
Come on.
Cut him off!
Come on, there's got to be like at least one point of this film that you probably enjoyed.
To introduce the second person, that's why the amazing Cliff action figure comes with him. Hiya.
Okay.
They're interlocking action figures.
I really want these to be real. That'd be amazing.
No, they wouldn't.
Well, as you heard, also joining us is Ash Versus from the Under Consultation podcast. Welcome to the Wolfie Pod, mate.
Thank you. I know it's been a long time coming. There's been a number of false starts, a number of delays. And, I've listened to the first part of the films of 1997, and I'm just, looking at all the films of 1997, and of all the movies that you could have me on to talk about, I get this.
Well, it was because I think on one of your Under Consultation extra podcasts, I think you mentioned the fact that you wanted to go back and rewatch this in 4K. And I latched onto that with everything because we were just coming into 1997, and I just thought it would be a glorious opportunity to hear your thoughts in a longer chance than you would probably normally get to talk on your own podcast about your experiences with rewatching this film. So you've only got yourself to blame, really.
I say a lot of things on those podcasts. I claim I'm going to go back and rewatch a lot of stuff. Guess what? 99% of the time, it never happens.
But this time it did.
Yeah, and I'm resenting you for it already. I actually did go and look through all the lists, because obviously last episode, you talked about Mars Attacks and Starship Troopers.
That's right.
And there was a third one. Was there a third
Tomorrow
one?
Never Dies.
Tomorrow Never Dies, my favourite Brosnan Bond film. And I was just looking at the other films of 1997, not even necessarily the good ones, but the bad ones. I mean, Anaconda, great B-movie. That came out in 1997. An actually really good film, and one that really cemented me on liking the director. Chasing Amy, that was a 1997 film. The most glorious hair out of Nicolas Cage, Con Air, was 1997.
Why can't we be talking about Con Air?
Can we change this now? We'll meet up next week, Connor.
We had two volcano movies, Dante's Peak and Volcano.
Yeah. Oh, Volcano.
And all these, and Event Horizon, probably the best Paul W.S. Anderson film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And all these things. And then I'm just sat here with the 4K of Batman and Robin in my hand, which I only own because it was cheaper to buy a Spanish version of the 4K 90s movies than just Batman and Batman Returns on their own.
Well, I'm really sorry.
But you will be by the end of this podcast.
It's just a great excuse to get you guys back on and talk about a decent movie, maybe.
I mean, yeah, I was about to say, thanks for having me back on the podcast, even though I've never been here before.
Oh, dear. Okay. Well, I was going to ask you, Ash, to let the listeners know, if they don't know who you are and what do you do?
I mean, my name is Ash Versus. If you think that's my real name, congratulations, you're not alone. At least one person did DM me going, Versus is a weird surname. Where is that from? And I'm like, I'm like, Estonian. Roll with it.
See how far that line can go.
I am a podcaster, an opinionator. I work in the wrestling business as well for at least one of my jobs, which is kind of weird. Like, me and Cliff are kind of like on the same sort of, well, not page, more kind of section of the library, I guess. Mm-hmm. And you can hear me on Under Consultation, the Games Master Retrospective podcast, where we have been for the past 2+ years covering every single episode of Games Master one at a time, and we are currently approaching the end of Series 5, where Dominic Diamond is in heaven.
Well, not for much longer.
No, not for much longer. He gets kicked out. And if you've heard interviews with Dominic Diamond, as listeners of this podcast, you probably will have, you can understand why he might get kicked out of heaven. I should say, I don't do this journey alone. Of course, I have a co-host on it. His name is Luke Owen. He also works in the wrestling business. There's a link between us all here, I think. And yes, we come at it from slightly different angles, because when Games Master was broadcast, I was a teenager and Luke was not. Every week he makes me feel old.
That's what these guys do on this podcast, because they're a few years younger than me. So every time we do a recording, I do feel that little bit older. So you're not on your own. But it's a great podcast and everyone should go and check it out, even if you're not really into Games Master, because, you know, you guys cover a lot of just 90s stuff as well. You know, you do your movies and you cover the TV shows that's around in your timeline at that point. And you go off and you talk about quite a lot of different things, not just necessarily Games Master. And yeah, it's just a great show to listen to. So everyone should really just go and give it a chance. It's a wonderful podcast. So now we know what you do for fun, but we want to get to know you a little bit more, Ash. So you know what's coming, right?
Oh, I have a good idea. I mean, I have actually listened to the podcast before, he claims.
I know, and that's really cool to hear. I mean, that they actually listen to our rambling. It's great. Thank you very much. But as you know what's coming, I'll just remind the little listeners, I have 10 Would You Rather questions ready to go that I'm now going to quick fire at Ash. And we're just going to see what his responses are. I'm wondering what his answer will be to number 10.
Way to tip the hand.
So if you're sitting comfortably, Ash, we shall begin. Would you rather wear winter clothes all summer or summer clothes all winter?
Summer clothes all winter.
Would you rather play Super Mario World or Super Mario 64?
Ooh, you changed that one since the last one. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I wonder why. What are they leaning into?
I mean, for repeated plays, and I think even the amazing Cliff might agree with me, Super Mario World.
I do, yes.
Would you rather talk like Yoda or breathe like Darth Vader for the rest of your life?
Talk like Yoda. I can always edit around it.
Would you rather play Jet Set Radio or Crazy Taxi?
Jet Set Radio.
Would you rather be a character in a video game or in a movie?
In a video game.
Would you rather watch the Super Mario Bros. Film or the Street Fighter film?
Super Mario Brothers movie.
Would you rather live twice as long or win the lottery?
Oh, win the lottery. Life's long enough as it is.
Would you rather play Tomb Raider on the PlayStation or the Saturn?
PlayStation.
Would you rather have to sing everything you want to say or talk in rhyme?
Talk in rhyme. I come worryingly close as it is sometimes.
And number 10, would you rather watch Babylon 5 or Star Trek Deep Space Nine?
Star Trek? No, it would actually be Babylon 5.
Hey! We finally have a Babylon 5 fan. So tell me, why would you rather watch Babylon 5 over Star Trek Deep Space Nine?
I mean, I am actually a fan of both. There is still, even today, a war between Babylon 5 fans and Star Trek fans over plagiarism and rip-offs. I mean, it's fairly well documented that Paramount executives had seen the pitch and the script bible for Babylon 5 way before Deep Space mm-hmm. Nine went into production, and there was even a lawsuit that was settled out of court. But the thing is, Deep Space Nine, because it's part of the Star Trek canon, is always being broadcast somewhere. You can flip through Freeview or satellite or cable or hop on Netflix, and Deep Space Nine has been there. So I guess it's always more in my kind of like peripheral vision than Babylon 5, which doesn't get repeated that often. And so I would rather pick Babylon 5. I was a big fan of Babylon 5 at the time. I definitely got into it more than Deep Space Nine. Visually, I think Deep Space Nine has aged better. I will say that. You know, some of the CGI effects used in Babylon 5 are definitely showing their age, and it's a shame we will never get like kind of a full Star Trek The Next Generation style restoration, or even the original series kind of revamp like the Trek series got. Mm-hmm. But I have a lot of love for Babylon 5. I have a lot of love for the cast. I appreciate the stories they told. I think some of the stories they told about political unrest, societal shifts and everything are just as valid today as they were in the 90s. In fact, in some ways, even more valid today. And yeah, I think it doesn't get all the credit it deserves. It does get to be the punchline for a lot of things, and that's fair enough. It's a big show. It can take care of itself. But because I see Deep Space Nine more often, just because it's there, I would pick Babylon 5.
This made me think about it in a better light, to be fair. So I guess you're right in some ways. I mean, I watched a handful of episodes back in the day, but I never really watched the whole lot, so I probably never really gave it the chance it deserved. And maybe it's something to go back and rewatch and just probably see if it's probably better than my memory tells me it is.
I will say it's like Next Gen. Next Gen Series 1 is awful.
Oh,
like,
God.
For the most part, it is just like Star Trek Next Generation hits the ground running in Series 2. Deep Space Nine has its good moments from the off, but to be honest, they also were kind of running with a lot of the same crew as Next Generation, so they cheated a little on that one. But Babylon 5 Series 1 has some great moments, but is a lot rougher. Series 2, 3 and 4, with its kind of like various story arcs and consistent cast members, that's where the good times are. You could probably kind of get an essentials episode list for Series 1 and just kind of cherry pick those, and then kind of hit the mainstream for 2, 3 and 4.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. They might actually just do that. Yeah, it's a great idea.
They have been remastered into HD recently as well.
Although that's definitely much better.
The CGI has just been upscaled because I think most of the... Well, one, they don't want to spend the money. Two, I think a lot of the original files and data have been lost. I mean, the film elements of Babylon 5 were thought to be lost for years after the fire on the Warner Brothers backlot that tore through the film archives. A lot of people presumed that Babylon 5 was lost amongst those.
Thankfully not.
So, yeah.
Some great answers there, Ash, and they definitely did choose the right Super Mario game. Well done.
Indeed.
Okay, well, on to our main event, and let's get talking about Batman and Robin.
Stop! Oh! Drop your weapon! Stop or you'll shoot!
The Iceman cometh.
Please, show some mercy.
Mercy? I'm afraid that my condition has left me cold to your pleas of mercy. There's only one absolute. everything freezes.
I freeze. I'm Batman.
We start the movie by seeing Bruce and Dick getting suited and booted. Plus, we get to see the Batcave, the car, the gadgets, and then we jump straight into a battle scene with Freeze. And I mean, was this the best way to start this film?
Batman on ice. It's Batman on
Batman
ice.
Batman on ice, yes.
It's just
not as
missing...
good as the Empire on ice.
No, as I say, it is missing the songs.
That's Robot what Chicken missing. Ruined Star Wars for me.
Or enhanced it, some might say.
Yeah,
but no, I think that it's, you know, I watched it, obviously, you know, I'm same age as Luke, so I'm going to make Ash feel very old. But I watched it 11 years old. At the end of the day, it was stupid over the top. So 11-year-old Cliff actually really, really loved this sort of moment of there being a dinosaur, Batman sort of skating down Zed dinosaur, then obviously the weird ice hockey game with the diamond. I think it's just, like a lot of this movie, a complete mess writing, but at the same time, visual senses all a go-go because there's so much going on, there's so much happening, and there's so much just batshit crazy. That's the best way to put it.
Yeah, but by yourself, Ash.
I was going to say, can I just check, just quick reminder, because I've forgotten already, what are the rules about swearing on this podcast?
Oh, you go for it, mate.
Oh, cool. Fuck off, Cliff, for making me feel old. My first note, because I like went through and I did watch the 4K, and, you know, we'll get this bit out of the way first. The 4K restoration does look lovely. It's got a better restoration than it deserves. Mm. The Dolby Atmos surround sound mix, which I also got to watch it in, is very nice, very sympathetic. It's kind of bombastic, which this film deserves, but it's nice and clean. There's not too much artificial noise removal in it. It's also not kind of too grainy, which you wouldn't expect of a film of this era. But yeah, if I'm going to watch a film like this, this is probably the best I'm ever going to see it. That being said, some things really don't hold up well. Right from the credits, the 90s morph CGI of the WB logo into the logo. And it's just like, whoa. And then it's followed by title credits that look like they're best watched on a Nintendo Virtual Boy.
Yeah. Did anyone notice that Arnold Schwarzenegger's name comes before anybody else's name in that title sequence? So literally, literally before Batman, like Arnold Schwarzenegger's there. Yes, his movie, not Batman's.
Well, that's because he got $25 million.
But Jack Nicholson was credited before Michael Keaton in the 89.
Oh, was he really as well? Yep. That's quite cool.
Because he was the bigger star. He was the bigger bankable star, so he was top billed. Michael Keaton's name came second on the credits.
That makes sense.
I mean, Joel Schumacher said to Arnold Schwarzenegger that, like, you know, if you don't sign on to this movie, I'm not making this movie.
Yeah,
or at least so Arnold claims. And to be honest, Joel might have claimed as well. There's a lot of people that claim a lot of things about this movie. Technically, we start this film with a fight sequence. And we don't need Batman and Robin introduced. We are three films deep at this point into the kind of 80s into 90s Batman. And technically, that's the scene that starts it, apart from the fact that what we actually start is pictures of Bat Codpiece and Bat Arse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And obviously,
Joel has his tastes.
And also, they have to get the toys in there because obviously, this movie is all about the toys. So you have to see the new Batmobile because, you know, you've got to see Disco Ball Batmobile straight away because the kids need to know what they're going to ask the kid, mum and dads for Christmas.
Looking into this movie and knowing about this movie introduced me to one of the most repulsive words I've ever heard out of the Hollywood system. Toyetic.
Oh, don't. Yes.
And the thing is like, I watched all the supplementary documentaries on the Batman and Robin Blu-ray because, you know, I was tidying the living room this afternoon and you may as well have those on in the background. And I saw the designers going, oh, when we did the Batmobile, we wanted to have this and we wanted to do this. And we wanted to have it to be an open canopy so you felt like Batman was part of the Batmobile. And I'm like, bullshit, you did that because it's much easier to make a Batmobile toy where you don't have a roof and you just drop the Batman figure in. That's why it doesn't have a roof.
Yep.
And also, you would need to have the, as I said, the Discoid ball inside it as well. So you could have the standard version and then the premium version.
The deluxe that light has up version.
Exactly. You need that deluxe light up version for the posh kids. Or the 20-somethings that want to collect the next Batman.
And then it becomes rare and then they're in someone's basement forever.
Who's buying that now?
Exactly. But I mean, I remember, like, to quote Tim Bisley from Space, it's just a two-hour jumped-up toy commercial, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, like, 1997, I was just 13. Before the movie was even out, I think I've still got some of them. I had, like, the official magazine of the film and poster mags and stuff. I was obsessed with Batman. And I liked Batman Forever, but I was 11. Batman Forever was all right. I enjoy it, I still do. And then Batman and Robin comes along and I'm just gearing up for it. And we go and see it and I'm just like, what? And for someone so young, at like barely 13, you're like, that's not good when even people that age can work out that you've just thrown loads of post-it notes to the wall and made a cohesive plot out of random stuff. And it's so exposition heavy. It's just like they've gone, let's remake Batman 1966 with modern effects.
Yeah, I have that in my notes.
I've seen people on YouTube adding the pow, whack, zap stuff to these fight sequences, and it's funny as fuck. Because it works, because of the Dayglow stuff, and yes, Joel Schumacher loves that Dayglow neon UV paint look. Perfect for his interpretation. But it's so exposition heavy. Like, ridiculously so. As I was watching it the other day, I was, as a grown-up, you're like, wow. Like, set up Mr. Freeze, Alfred just says, no, or is it Commissioner Gordon or so? Oh, there's a new villain, Mr. Freeze. That's all you need to know. 5 minutes in, we're into the action. We've got Batman and Robin fighting Mr. Freeze. They've told the audience, new villain, Mr. Freeze, here he is. Go.
Sounds like WWE booking.
Yeah. <it does. laughs>
Well, much like the WWE, during this opening fight sequence, Mr. Freeze, for some reason, has a follow spot. I've never quite worked that out.
Yeah.
He's walking around, and some fucker is operating a spotlight, just going, hey, we've got to keep this guy in the light. That suit costs a lot of money. Arnold costs a lot of money.
It took him 6 hours to get this damn thing. We made sure he's got enough light on him.
But you mentioned about the skiing down the dino tail and the ice skating blades, and man, watching it as an adult, it made my eyes roll, and even as a 13-year-old, it sounds like it probably made your eyes roll. And I mean, it was so geared for the younger audience, just to make as much money out of toys and stuff like that. But also in this scene, by the end of it, I was already fed up with the quips.
Oh, and God.
That was
to see you.
They're some of the best.
The ice.
They're some of the best. Chill out, bird boy. It's the break in the words. It's just like, what the hell is going on?
Your bags leave me cold.
And by the end of the first scene, I'd had enough. Let alone by the end of the movie, where there's hundreds more. But we'll get to the writing at some point. Following this scene, we get to see the creation of Poison Ivy and Bane.
My beautiful boy, what have they done to you?
Oh, don't, because I'd imagine lots of you will be the same, and I know definitely Ash is, that I loved Nightfall. This is the time when, obviously, I just listened to Nightfall. The BBC audio drama had come out, and you had Bane, the brilliant villain in this, like with his South American accent. And then you had the Pokemon that we had in this that can only say his own blasted name. Oh,
God.
So angry. Ah.
Monkey! Yeah, just painful to see what they did with this character. And why do you have any opinions on why you think they did this to Bane?
Because Bane, as he was designed in this movie, made a really cool action figure.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it is. And it's also too many villains spoil the broth. You know, you had obviously Batman Forever beforehand with the two villains. Well, we've got to up the ante here. We've got to have the third villain. And He just plays the hired muscle, and that is all he does. So you don't need hired muscle to have big, intelligent, oh, this is why I'm here, this is why I'm doing this, as going back to Nightfall and his whole mission in that to, you know, release everybody from the Arkham Asylum. Spoilers. But I generally think that that's the only reason. Why do you need to give him any dialogue? He is just... Bane.
He's basically airbrushed odd job. That is his role in this movie. And I look at how they kind of documented his creation here. And by the way, Dr. Woodrue, amazing mad scientist. Like they went proper batshit on him, and I appreciate that. But
I liked it.
Almost imagine kind of like that Joel and the writers and that just going, okay, well, we need kind of a henchman. Who do we have from the Bat universe? Oh, Killer Croc's going to be way too expensive. So's Clayface. Yeah. Solomon Grundy, well, that's just too weird. Also, he's grey. We can't sell grey action figures. So what about this Bane guy? He's fueled by Venom. What do you mean Venom? Oh, just go with snake venom. That's close enough.
And it really annoys me, like, when he's actually, like, defeated at the end of the movie, spoilers, that, you know, all it takes from this big, massive, muscle, strong dude is just to, like, kick the pipe out of the back of his head.
They just sort of did that in Dark Knight Rises as well. So it's technically, he just unplugged something in the side of his neck.
It is like the biggest design flaw since the kind of ports on the Death Star. It's just like, no one will ever find that. Oh, you can just kick the hose out and he suddenly does the Wicked Witch from the beginning of The Wizard of Oz. Just like, I'm melting! What a world! What a world!
I mean, like you say, they needed a henchman, but I mean, they could have just made a henchman out of just somebody and just not given them a name and just left Bane alone, you know.
Like Bob, the number one guy in Batman 89.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Bloody love me a bit of Bob. Yeah. Could do with more Bob.
Yeah, yep. You are my number one guy. But can I just say what an amazing, captivating performance by Uma Thurman?
Yeah.
Yes, no, I
Given
agree.
The source material is so... Well, not source material, sorry, the script is just so shockingly simplistic. But she throws her all into this film. When we got Uma Thurman... at the cusp of the height of her powers right now. Couple of years after this, she'll be doing Kill Bill 1 and 2. And she's just amazing. I found myself going, you're like the only thing in this film that I'm really like gravitating towards. It's just fantastic. That nuance.
I think that Uma and Arnie, that the reason I think they're the two that stand out, obviously, you know, the presser as well, when as I agree with Woodrow, he's brilliant. But if I was to look at them two, the reason why they work a lot better is that they know what this movie is. They know that this is stupid camp. And that's what they do. They ham it up. And I think that the actors that don't work, which I'm sure we'll go into on in a minute, the reason that they don't work is because they take it so seriously. They're taking it so, so seriously where, Uma and Arnie, definitely not. They know what this is.
And they're having a really good time just going with it, aren't they?
I actually think, like, I genuinely, when I was watching this movie earlier and I was trying to, one, pay attention to it, and two... be as fair with it as I could. The one thing I took away from it is I actually don't think any of the actors do a bad job given what they were given and also the constraints they were operating in. There's actually an interview with George Clooney where, one, he apologises for the movie, as he always does, but he's also just talking about it was a really difficult role to go into because Michael Keaton kind of defined a cinematic Batman. Val Kilmer kind of did the Timothy Dalton. He took it darker and more brooding, or at least tried to, despite the push
for toys.
It's a good
analogy. I've never thought about it that way, actually.
And he's like, so what does that leave me with? What can I do? Because we've already had two rounds of the tortured kind of billionaire. And he quite rightly went, so I'm a guy in my 30s that's a billionaire playboy. Why don't I kind of play up the playboy bit? And actually he's quite similar to the Adam West Batman. I mean, no one would ever look at Batman 66 and Adam West and go, well, he's tortured by the death of his parents.
And also Alicia Silverstone, she just great English accent all the way through this as well, so you know, great anti-chops.
Even the compost line.
It genuinely breaks my heart to hear some of the stuff she went through on this movie, particularly in the press tours afterwards and the body shaming. That's just, it's pretty bloody horrible.
Yeah, especially for her age.
Yeah, it's really kind of, it's no wonder so many young actors in Hollywood just end up completely screwed up when you get that sort of reaction from the press. But no, I thought she was great in this, even though I don't quite understand. Well, I do understand why Batgirl is now Alfred's kind of niece, not really a niece. And it's simply because Commissioner Gordon, bless him, is a non-character in these movies.
Yeah.
Although you need to ground it into some narrative that you're the characters you're attached to. Which is why a lot of these adaptations, like we always mention, like, why did they change that? Well, they needed to for narrative purposes.
But as we're already talking about the cast, let's just carry on with that for now. And you've mentioned about George Clooney and like how he played Batman. Obviously still struggled with the writing and what they expected from him, do you think?
It depends on the context, because I was aware of George Clooney before, because my mum used to watch ER, so it was always on like a weekend night, you know, when ER was on. And she always used to say, like, that's the new Batman. And I always remember going, like, what do you mean it's a new Batman? Like, I didn't have any concept of that as a kid. Never occurred to me. But I think in the context of the film, he'd literally come straight from filming ER to filming scenes on the set for Batman. So I think he was just extremely fortunate and just ran with it.
Yeah. There was a story that he went to the ER set full-on Batman costume just to fuck around with his mates.
Yeah, because I think he was just fully aware of, like, this could be my lucky break, and he's like, I don't care what to throw at me, I'm just going to do it, like, straight up.
He sort of said in interviews afterwards that he sort of said that the Batman role, he didn't think that, because he was the third Batman, and it's almost like you're taking on such a responsibility. And he sort of said that he didn't really take the role to heighten his career. It was more the case of, well, it's Batman, it's going to be once in a lifetime thing to do this. Because obviously, it's two people now Batman, obviously Kilmer, up for debate, but it's two people now Batman. He said, I think he pretty much said, there's only one thing I can do here, and that's mess this up.
And you know, out of everything that came out of this film, this was the film that kind of propelled him into Hollywood and kick-started his career on that path. So at least something came out of it.
Although, kind of, I didn't know, I didn't watch ER, but I had seen this little horror comedy that he did in 1996 called From Dusk Till Dawn.
Yeah, From Dusk Till Dawn.
Yeah,
and that to me was like, when I heard he was going to be Batman, I think I was like, oh, cool, the guy from Dusk Till Dawn. Mm-hmm. That was a cool movie. It also involved bats.
And Little Shop of Horrors as well, wasn't he? He was Little Shop of... Am I right there? Little Shop of Horrors?
Was he in that?
I don't think he...
He was in Attack of the Killer Tomatoes.
Ah, that's what I'm thinking. There you go.
Which spawned a cartoon and every God knows what else.
If I'm going to pull a Luke and push my glasses up my nose, it's technically Return of the Killer Tomatoes that he was in.
Righty dokey.
Nerds.
To coin a phrase, duh.
Yeah.
And obviously we've talked about Irma Thurman and the way that she played Poison Ivy, and like we could tell with Arnie, like, how what a great time that they were having with just what they were given, and just amped it up to the hundreds levels and such. But one person we haven't really talked about is Chris O'Donnell and how he portrayed Robin. What's our opinions on how he portrayed that character?
I think with Robin, he sort of plays the same character as he does in Forever. And I know that sounds a bit odd because obviously it is the same character, but I don't feel that there's anything different about that character. I showed Ash a picture of the breakdown, because I said that pretty much fundamentally this movie follows the same steps as Batman Forever. So I said, introduce Batman and villain, second villain backstory, introduce snotty teenager, Batman and villain fight, introduce Batman to them. It's a snotty teenager goes on joyride, big villain moment, snotty kid becomes sidekick, big second villain, and Batman saves the day. So I think that with this, obviously you've got Barbara coming in as well, Batgirl. I think that I would have liked to have seen a bit more of his development in the story. I know maybe, you know, we're talking about Batman and Robin here. However, it's that element of that he's just playing the same character as he did in Forever.
Yeah.
I think he's also checked out a bit. I mean, he was one of the people that has fairly publicly gone quite early on. I didn't feel like I was making a movie. I felt like I was making a toy commercial. Mm. And I think it comes across in his performance that he has checked out of this movie.
Yeah, he's throwing just to get it done and fulfill that contract.
Yeah, I mean, technically, he never starred opposite Arnold Schwarzenegger in this movie. Mm. It was always a body double because one or the other of them was using a stunt double. He spent lots of times with Arnold on the set shooting the shit, having a chat and all that, but they never actually got to act opposite each other because they were always like three separate units going at the same time filming stuff. It was just so absolutely, utterly, mind-bogglingly chaotic and disorganized.
I
think he was also a bit salty that Val Kilmer wasn't there because I think he got on quite well with Val Kilmer.
No, I'm a big fan of Batman Forever. They took a different route. It's not as good as the first two. Don't hate me. But the way he plays Dick Grayson / Robin is so genuine and honest in Batman Forever. And I think that's partly due to the kind of like paternal instinct that maybe Val Kilmer had on him, like ushering him in like the generation below him. So I think there was that kind of dynamic going on. In this, like you just said, he just feels like he's sleepwalking through it, like literally, like, and it takes me out of it because when I watched it, I was like, he's not the Dick Grayson I remember from Batman Forever. It feels like a total disconnect, like he's the image, but not the character. He's just literally just random words thrown and given to Chris O'Donnell, isn't it? Like, that's what it felt like.
I mean, some of his role is kind of split between him and Barbara now. Mm. Like there isn't actually, for all the exposition we get in this movie, and we do get a bunch of it, there isn't actually that much plot to go around for Robin. His main plot is, I feel like Batman is smothering me.
Yeah.
And I really want to shag Poison Ivy. That's his plot.
You hit something there, because they're trying to do so much in this film, aren't they? It's another great example of just trying to fit in so much in a superhero film. You know, they're setting up Poison Ivy, they're setting up Mr. Freeze, they're setting up Batgirl and Barbara. They're trying to give conflict between Batman and Robin, and they're trying to do all this different stuff in this 2-hour film, and it's just that little bit too much, isn't it?
It's almost going back to what I said about the villains of, oh, well, this is why Bane, because we've shoehorned in another villain. Well, they've also shoehorned in another hero.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually, yeah. But they didn't really need... I mean, this film could have been just fine without Batgirl, couldn't it?
It could have been fine without Bane.
I mean, there was the argument with Batgirl that Joel did say, you know, he wanted to create a powerful role model for girls, which is admirable at any point in film, particularly because what little existed of the superhero movie genre at that point, women weren't treated very favourably. Mm-hmm. The only two women that had really appeared in the Batman movies up until this point with substantial roles and some degree of character arc were Catwoman and, in this movie, Poison Ivy.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, but like, if you're going to have Batgirl, don't have Robin. Have him be off in Europe doing something else.
Yeah.
Have that be the reason why she becomes Batgirl.
Yep.
Yeah. Actually earn it.
As opposed to just guessing a really shit password.
yeah.
Is it England? No. I love the pervy little voice that it gives when it's it goes, access granted. Where it was access denied, it was a bit angry, Dalek-y.
It's like, oh, it's my God, Uncle cases. Alfred's search history. Yeah. What the hell?
He's searching for boats and what's this? No, don't click on that.
Founding father of Pornhub.
Yeah.
Alfred OnlyFans.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
The only other person that is it worth talking about is Ellie McPherson in the film. I mean, she didn't really do much there, did she?
No, pointless.
No, her entire role was cut out of the film before they even got to shoot it.
Yeah.
She was meant to die.
Oh, was she really?
Well,
yeah. I didn't hear this.
Yeah, she was meant to be killed. She was meant to have a much bigger role, and she was meant to die. And that was pretty much all excised from the film before they shot it. And so she's just there. There are actually two cast members I did want to bring up because they were the last vestiges of the Burton era. And that is Pat Hingle and Michael Goff as Commissioner Gordon and Alfred, respectively. Mm-hmm. And Michael Goff in particular is a big interest to me because I'm a Doctor Who fan and he's got history there. But also he's the only person to, I think, play Alfred opposite four separate Batmans. Because he was also Alfred in the BBC Radio Nightfall adaptation.
Indeed he was.
That was it. That's literally, that's my point, is they just kept the two. It's kind of like having Moneypenny and M and Q in the Bond movies. They just kind of transition between the different Bonds.
Hmm. I don't think that they're the only two actors that have done four Batman movies. Like, there's no other actors that I can think of that have done, well, obviously four movies and the radio for Michael Goff. But yeah, no, I can't think of any two actors that have done more Batman movies, really. Maybe West.
Maybe
Adam West.
We're talking about Alfred as well, and I quite liked his plot line actually in this film. I think it was quite cool just to, you know, see Alfred that a little bit more, that we usually just see him, you know, just standing in the arch going, would you like your bat suit ready, sir? Or would you like some lobster, sir? Or whatever, you know, they tried to give him something a little bit more and feature him in something different.
It's extremely tropey, but it kind of works. It's like putting Q in the field, like this like guy in his 70s goes out to see James Bond in the field and it just works.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I kind of appreciate that a little bit, that they at least tried with Alfred, but yet again, that was something else that they were trying to squeeze into the plot.
It was almost there to make reason for Mr. Freeze's plot, really, isn't it? It's more of alongside that, well, how that can that affect Batman?
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, we see like at the beginning that, you know, something's not quite right with Alfred, and that kind of continues throughout the film until to the end where we find out what's actually going on and the miracle cure that he finally gets, and he's right as rain the next day, so you know it's all good in the end. But it was an interesting plot point anyway. But where we are in the film now is that, you know, we've been introduced to Barbara, and we see that obviously not all is right with Alfred. The next thing I want to talk about is the auction one for many reasons. So Batman and Robin have kind of set a trap and hope Freeze will come along to steal some diamonds that he needs. An infamous part of the film just for that terrible Batman credit card scene.
all never leave the play without it.
Why not send Junior home early? I've got some wild oats to sow. On the other hand, youth does have its advantages. Endurance. Stamina. Forget the geriatric bat. Come join me. My garden needs tending. I'll take it from here, pal.
Wouldn't you like the earrings too?
Some lucky boy's about to hit the honeypot. I'll include an evening of my company for the winner. I'll bring everything you see here, plus everything you don't.
$50,000 for poison ivy. $100,000. And I'm in $500,000.
$1 million.
$2 million.
You don't have it. $3 million.
I'll borrow it from you. $4 million.
$5 million.
That's a utility belt, not a money belt. $6 million.
$7 million. Never leave the cave without it.
You two boys aren't going to start fighting over little old me now, are you?
All the good work they did with Batwoman, so Batgirl as well. And then we get a scene where loads of dirty old men are bidding for women. Mm. It's a bit of a turn for the 90s.
I see that. But yeah, it was just another, I don't know, it was just another fight scene in the end that I felt I kind of already seen.
It also really kind of I mean, one, it is very 66 Batman to have Batman just like out publicly with Robin at a charity fundraiser. That's like a straight out of the 66 Batman series. But not only that, they are literally publicly arguing about spending millions and millions of dollars, and not one person in that audience is like, that guy must be a billionaire or something. Hey, wait a minute.
But can we, I don't know, wait, well, why that credit card thing? I mean, well, what? Just why? They're just
product placement?
Yeah, I guess so.
It was the fact that it said valid until forever. It was like,
sound effect. The sound effect. It needed that sound effect. Cha-ching!
Cha-ching!
And I guess this was the first time I noticed the comic slipping sound effects when people were slipping over and such. And
yeah, there are so many. I watched it through headphones and you pick up so much more that is almost, it's almost worth a high five to the sound designers that they went the distance and did that to all the scenes.
I reckon they had a bunch of leftover sound effects from the German dub of the Ninja Turtles movie, where they added in all those boing, wong, 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 wong noise. Although, as you mentioned sound, I do just want to see any of the rest of you just absolutely sick to the eye teeth of that musical cue. Yes. It's just playing on a... It's like an attract mode in an arcade, just the...
Was that the Elliot Goldenfall Batman Forever thing?
Yeah. Yeah. Just it's they could not be bothered to compose a new score for this movie, so it's just playing. It's like the Star Wars Cantina band. They have one song. This has one piece of music, and it plays right at the beginning of the film, and then in the next scene. And that there are actually more scenes with this cue in than there are not. Anything involving Batman, it's going to be there, and it's so intrusive.
Yeah, it didn't work, and I guess that kind of makes you feel like you, like what I said a minute ago, like you. You feel like you've already seen this again and again. You feel like you're just on loop, seeing the same kind of battles and the same kind of music, and it just gets a bit boring. And do you think that the capture freeze was a bit weird?
It all happened off screen kind of thing. Like, you had the chase sequence, you had the kind of rift between Batman and Robin starting to show, because like Batman literally shuts Robin down, almost kills him in the process. Not quite sure about that one. And then you think you're going to get this massive sequence because Batman's managed to escape the frozen Batmobile and he's coming gliding in, and it's going to be a big fight sequence. But oh wait, we've only got Arnold for 12 hours a day. Crap. Okay, we'll just wave a cape over him. And that's it.
Yeah.
Freeze is arrested, although does give us my favourite cameo in the movie. When Freeze is taken into his Arkham jail cell, one of the prison guards is Jesse the Body Ventura.
I was going to say this, Nice. It is a really, you know, because obviously you've got wrestling connection with Bane there, but to see Ventura, I think... I even noticed that back when I was an 11-year-old, being obsessed with WWF at the time. It's really nice. Obviously, you've got Coolio later on as well. But those two little cameos, brilliant.
Coolio, by the way, just to leap ahead, Coolio technically playing an unnamed Dr. Crane, because he was meant to be the Scarecrow in the next movie.
No, I never knew that.
I had no idea about that.
Apparently so. I found that while digging around the internet. Again, that's anything to do with this movie, take with a pinch of salt, but he was meant to return.
No,
and he was meant to play the Scarecrow. Coolio is the Scarecrow. What a world we'd be living in. But yeah, Jesse Ventura turns up, and in my notes I just put, then does some acting in air quotes.
Bless him.
When I was watching it, I was actually... taken aback, because the guy playing, I can't remember the scientist's name, works with Pamela Isley.
Dr. Actually, Jason Woodrue.
Yeah, was actually played by Lex Luthor's father from Smallville.
Was he really?
The character actor.
Oh, what was his name?
He's been in everything. And I was sat there watching, and I was like, why do I know you? And it just clicked.
It's John Glover in Batman and Robin, because technically the character is actually a supervillain in the comics. Like, he's kind of a bit like Poison Ivy, the Floronic Man. And they just made him a mad scientist, because he's also appeared in a bunch of other things. He's been in Swamp Thing, a couple of other... I think it was the Swamp Thing TV series he appeared in. I don't know if he appeared in the movie. But yeah, John Glover was the guy that played him in this.
May I present Antonio Diego, serial murderer serving life in prison, and sole surviving volunteer. And what a charmer he is. By merely drilling three concentric holes directly into Antonio's cranial cavity, I have created viaducts into the most primitive part of his brain, the limbic system. And now I add my super soldier serum, codenamed Venom, to which I add my very own recipe of steroids and toxins. Like a myth, time to scream.
But as we were saying, like every fight scene is well, to me, kind of the same throughout the film. But I guess what put it apart was the different sets and the props and stuff like that. How do you guys think they kind of pulled it off? Do you think they did a good job with some of this stuff? But I mean, there was one thing I noticed a bit later on in the film where Gotham was being frozen and someone got out of a car and you could see the ice cube wobble. Which is what I
funny to bring that up, like the opening of the film. Did everyone like the defrosting the waxwork Chris O'Donnell model mannequin in the warm water that was warmed up with a bat laser?
Mm-hmm.
Anyone caught that?
Oh yes, yeah. and then he's all right. He just has a towel over his leg and his feet in some hot water in the Batcave afterwards. Yeah. Yes,
I was just like, that looks. Even for 1997, I remember being a kid, I was like, that looks ridiculously bad.
just on that context of the ice, I love it in this movie how the ice is very specific, because the same blast that freezes people absolutely solid, also the same amount precision when they're in the rocket, just holds Batman exactly on his hands. Doesn't cover his thumbs. However, it's very specific, this ice and the ice shooters. I've got to admit, some of the physical effects aren't too bad. I do like, let's say with sets, I do like the whole sort of poison ivy sort of sets with the random plant that eats her, things like that. I do like the very physical element because it does lean into that campy exterior, and I do like that actually. But if it, obviously we do know like how he loves neon paint, so Joel very much leans on everything is neon paint, even to the point of, you know, I do like sort of poison ivy's areas.
Some of the neon paint in the sets and on some of the characters must have looked pretty good in 4K, though, mustn't it?
The 4K really bigs up the physical sets. It really kind of bigs up the big, bold, bright colours. The production designer did some great stuff. I mean, Gotham City in this movie, even more than Batman Forever, and even more than the Burton movies, is kind of very extra. It's just like, why do we have these giant statues of naked men? Who knows? But they look kind of cool. Why are all the roads suspended 100 metres above? What is the insurance like in this city?
Can't stop crime, but can build massive statues.
I mean, that's always a problem in Gotham.
Billions of pounds on, like, 100 feet tall statues.
Why is this observatory being held by two hands? There is no infrastructure. Is it just being held there by
concerns?
Yeah, the observatory is just being held there by artistic integrity. That is the only thing keeping it up. But it looks great. And when they're doing the physical work, it looks great. We made jokes about the Batmobile, but the Batmobile does look pretty great, even though I would hate to be the person that has to pat test that amount of neon. It'd just be an absolute bloody mare. But no, I thought when they were doing the physical stuff, like the physical set work, the physical prop work, even the costumes, you know, we haven't mentioned the nipples really yet, but we'll get there. But I thought that, like the Mr. Freeze costume, it was a big old heavy 100-pound costume. You had to get Arnold to play him. He's the only person that could wear that crap. But it looks great. Like, it, particularly in 4K, wow, they went through a lot of effort making sure no fingerprints were on that. Because they would show up. Mm-hmm. If you know, I recently watched the fan 4K restoration of A New Hope. And boy, howdy, those Stormtroopers and Darth Vader are mucky pups. You see fingerprints all over those.
Yeah, and especially Darth Vader, you see a lot of them.
But here, it's just like everything looks great. It's only when they start to use the CGI, which was only just coming in, that it really struggles. And that's unfortunately to do with the Ivy Lair. Ivy's Lair, there's a lot of plant growing via CGI, and it looks bad. Mm-hmm. It's not even that it's aged badly. It just didn't look great at the time. This was one of two superhero movies that made some dodgy CGI usage that came out in 97, and the other was Spawn.
Mm. And they got really no excuse, really, have they? Because, like, where we mentioned in our movies of 97, we were talking about Starship Troopers and the special effects that were used in that and how well they did it. You know, that it could be done in that time much better than what they did here.
And Mars Attacks.
Yeah.
I mean, those Martians still look great today.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah, definitely. And so, yeah, again, it's just another, maybe they just didn't care as much about it, or they were just rushing it just to get the film out so they could get their toys and such. Don't really know. But yeah, it's just another shame that they just didn't put that little bit more polish on their CGI. And you mentioned about the costumes there a minute ago, Ash, and we might as well have a quick chat about the the costumes and the nipples. And how do we think the design of the bat suit and you know the costumes in general, how they did with those?
I love it how Alfred knows everyone's measurements and can create them, not just their own suits, but, you know, special silver ones just in case
just
they need them.
Yeah,
just in case they need them. But yeah,
and special ice vehicles as well.
Yeah, special ice vehicles. Yep. Always needs those ice vehicles just in case. But I think the sort of major point, because we'll come on to nip-nips in a minute, but one thing that I did listen to earlier today was the whole point of the bulge. So the codpiece. And in Batman Forever, Chris's codpiece was bigger than Val's. And then when Clooney came into this, he turned around and said, yeah, can you turn around and say that it was very specifically made for our anatomy and make mine bigger? So I like to think that's a tongue-in-cheek joke, but how, yeah, the situation with them and Val when casting, I don't, maybe it wasn't.
What do you think, Ash, of the way they managed the costumes?
Again, toyetics, the specific snow costumes are there because, hey, guess what? That is literally another action figure. Even though they actually ended up being repurposed Batman Forever suits in the end because they were running short of time, they just kind of cast some extra silver bits and slapped them on some Batman Forever suits for Batman and Robin, at least. I mean, I thought they were well executed. They suffer the same limitations that we'd had in the three movies previously, which is, you know, you can't look sideways. You have to turn your entire body and... That's always been an issue with those movies, but it kind of gives them a bit of charm. The capes were fine. The execution was fine. I thought Mr. Freeze was fine. Bane, I think, is probably the worst realised of the villains because he just looks ridiculous. Like, it looks, even by this film's standards, it actually stands out. And I heard a bit interesting bit in one of the making of documentaries about the Poison Ivy costume, which was really challenging because back at that point in time, latex was not as widely used as it is now for kind of fashion and various things. And so they were making that up as they went along. They had no idea what they were doing regarding pigments and colouring and how to colour latex and stuff like that. So apparently that was a real challenge. But if I look at it in the context of compared to, say, the Burton films, let's keep the Burton and the Schumacher film separate. I'm always going to choose the design aesthetic of the Burton films because that's my jam. I really like that. Burton was never going to do multiple bat suits, you know, just for toys, unless he wanted one where Batman had scissors for hands. And then we get to Schumacher, where, of course, you know, Batman Returns was way too dark for everyone involved at a studio level. And they were like, we can't sell Happy Meal toys. So right from Batman Forever, we had this move towards make things we can market. And the costumes in Batman and Robin are very marketable. They tie in nicely with those very marketable vehicles. And everything's good there. The only weird point, even though I understand why he did it, are the nipples. I've heard his justification, which is to do with Greek Adonises and gods and ancient statues. And I'm looking at the statues he's referencing and I'm going, yes, they had nipples. Mm-hmm. Definitely had nipples. But, like, the costumes would have looked just as impressive without them.
Mm. Yeah. It's just that age-old question, but why?
There is the argument, does Batgirl's costumes have nipples? And he claims they do, and on the 4K at least, I'm like, well, there's definitely kind of like the implication of a nipple. Kind of like if someone wears a sweater that's slightly too tight and there's a cold breeze. It's that kind of idea, the concept of a nipple is there. But they're not going to put nipples on the Batgirl costume because Alicia is very young, and also this is a kid's movie. You can't have female nipples in a kid's movie.
Nipples appear in Batman Forever. I think they appeared on Val Kilmer's last suit, didn't they, in the film?
I mean, maybe it was cold that day. I can't remember.
And then they just decided, let's just give them nipples all the way through.
Nipples for everyone. You know, Alfred has two circles cut out of his jacket.
Everybody gets nipples.
You get nipples. You get nipples.
Everyone. Gets nipples.
Apart from you. No, no, not teenager girl. No.
Alfred's a pierced.
With twiddly bits.
It's got with a chain and a tea strainer on it.
With little batarang charms hanging from the rings.
When I was looking at the Metacritics for this film, I came across a user review, and I want to read this out because the nipple talk just reminded me of it. And this person said, classic Batman. Before they went and made him all moody and miserable, this is a great movie. You've got to wonder why they didn't keep George Clooney in the role. At least he would have added a bit of humour to the role. Some people said this was rubbish because the Batsuit had nipples. Makes sense. Humans have nipples, people. And sometimes they protrude through clothes. Do any of you even watch Baywatch? Best villain ever alert. It's fucking Arnie. He's a baddie for the first time since the Terminator here. Always more believable as a villain. For those pining for a bit of Bane, he's also in this, and he gets killed, so it's the new one that looks dumb, and he's magically brought back to life. They did the same with Joker, Two-Face, Catwoman. This is the real deal, folks, except no substitutes. They gave this film a 10.
No. Was that Rich? Is that why Rich isn't here this evening? Because he didn't want to own up to this.
Well, if his name is Shankroyd on Metacritic, then maybe so, yes.
it sounds more like a hemorrhoid, that comment. Yeah, I was gonna say, right pain in my ass.
There are so many things in that review to pick apart that, one, my immediate response is that review is a parody. That review is deliberately there to upset people. And then I go over what was said again and I'm like, it's so stupid. It's probably real.
Yeah, that there's a higher percent chance that that is actually real than false, definitely.
I love the argument of, well, human beings have nipples, and I'm like, well, you know, technically, George Clooney also has a penis. You don't have bat dong flapping around.
Yeah, that is very true.
Would have been better.
It wouldn't have been worse.
Try selling a toy with that.
It's an action feature.
Yeah, adjustable.
It's got a little trigger button on the back of the action figure.
There's a little windmill. Hand pump on the back.
I was just imagining one of those little switches you front. Made it wiggle with a little switch on the back. Anyway.
Boy, that escalated quickly.
I know.
You wonder if the Batmobile is a penis extension? Well, wonder no more.
Yeah, that's the other thing that struck me, Joel Schumacher's that penchant for the phallic symbols in his films, especially his two Batmans. It was pointed out to me once and I could never unsee it.
And thank you, Chris, I shall never unsee it either.
No, no, no. Yeah, cheers, you mate. You think I'm shitting you? I'm not. It's the Batman Forever Batmobile, which is my second favourite next to the Tim Burton one. You look at it, it looks like a penis.
Please don't. You're just going to...
Right. I'm being serious, and it was pointed out to me, and I think it was it on a YouTube video I was watching about Batman Forever, and I was just like, thanks, guys, thanks. You can plainly see it, plain as day.
We are all Googling.
That's no, see,
I'm being
talking.
Serious, right? Look at the 95 Batman Forever Batmobile, and it's got the bud and the textures and the main vein, and once you understand it, it ruins it.
Well, if you really want a shocker to go in the absolute opposite direction, and I know we're talking about Batman Forever now, do you know who was originally brought in to design the Batmobile for Batman Forever?
Was it H.R. Giger?
It was, which is the literal opposite of a penis.
Yeah.
Because that Batmobile would have just been 100% vagina everywhere.
Well, let's get back to the film and...
Duh.
I know.
No, really?
We were having such a good time. And you had to ruin it.
That's my job, Ash. It's my job. We rejoin the film at Freeze's base as the police and Batman and Robin are investigating and come across Nora. Freeze, Bane and Ivy break in as Freeze needs more crystals for his suit. Ivy uses her love scent again to woo Batman and Robin. And this is not the first time and certainly not the last time we see Ivy use this tactic. But by this point, I'm already bored of it. And it just seems to be a one-trick pony for Ivy. I mean, surely she's got more tricks up her bag than just trying to woo men with her scent.
A scent that appears to be sentient, by the way, because no one in that production crew understands how airflow works.
Yeah, because it's very kind of wavy and straight to the where she wants it to go. Really, isn't it?
Yeah, I've not seen such sentient smoke since Disney's Aladdin.
But it's a shame, like I say, that it seems to be her only tactic in this film, and I would have liked to have seen a little bit more from her. The point of, like, Ivy killing Nora to I don't know, why did she do this? Why was it necessary?
Because Ivy's a one-woman show kind of girl. That's literally the justification the film offers. And also, it kind of sends Freeze on a revenge bent because, you know, Freeze is an interesting villain in the sense that, much like Dr. Octopus, depending on which version of Dr. Octopus you look at, is that they're not, like, inherently evil. They are doing what they do for a purpose, for a reason. And in Freeze's case, it's because he wants to save his wife. And therefore, Freeze's main deal is going to be, I need the money to continue my research. He has no reason to deliberately go after Batman and kill the Batman. Ivy finishes off, or attempts to, finish off Freeze's wife and then blames the Batman because she knows that will bring him back on side and make him as determined to end Batman's life as she is. It's a surprisingly competent bit of storytelling in this movie. Mm. And there is actually a really genuinely good scene at the end of this movie involving Batman and Freeze, which is ruined by a pun. But the scene is still good.
Yeah, take two of these and speak to me in the morning. Why did you have to do it?
I was waiting for someone to bring that up. It got me a giggle the other day.
Because it is a genuinely heart-wrenching... And even it's missing that lovely bit of music that Ash loves so much. Yeah. You know, it's actually got a very nice sort of like softer piece of music in the background as well. Yeah, no, it's a beautiful scene.
And we see it again, the Ivy scent at the observatory opening of this brand new telescope. And she uses it to woo Commissioner Gordon to let her and Bane onto the roof to rip up the bat sign. But was this necessary as well? Or do you think we could have just skipped through this scene as well?
I liked it because it gave Pat Hingle something to do.
This is true, yeah. Yeah, because, you know, that I guess that was the one character that really got punished in this film, was he didn't have anything to do with it. And he's quite a main character in the Batman universe, isn't he?
I'd say he's punished in all of the 90s movies. He doesn't get Jack Diddly Dick to do. And that's why Barbara is now this mysteriously unheard-of relative of Alfred's, because... Like, we don't even know if Gordon's married in this universe, let alone having a teenage to early 20s daughter.
It's just, it's just a shame. You know, and I guess that's probably one of the good things about the newer Batman films, that they gave Commissioner Gordon, just fleshed him out a little bit and gave him more screen time, and that was great to see. But, I mean, I can understand Ivy was trying to, you know, trying to get Robin onto her side, I guess. So this is why the bat sign was ripped up, wasn't it? So... we can have a Robin sign just to make Robin feel that little bit more important. But I just, it was just another part of the film I thought we could have just done without and concentrated on better things that they were trying to tell. So we get to a point where Barbara, I mean, throughout this film, Barbara's been sneaking off and she's been doing bike races and this, that and the other. And it's at this point where we get to her breaking into Alfred's computer to read the CD-ROM filled with all the Batman schematics, and she learns everything to do with Batman. You know, we see her find the Batcave, and digital Alfred talking to her and conveniently has a costume ready just in case this ever happened, as we mentioned. And then we see her suit-up scene in this kind of terrible close-ups of her bottom and breasts, and I guess it's just 290s, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, that's just something that would never happen now in a film because it was a little bit tasteless.
Ironically, she's quite well dressed for a female superhero. Normally, they're like next to nothing.
it is bat armor. I mean, the suits in this thing are. But, I mean, the shots that she gets are exactly the same shots that we got in the opening of Batman and Robin, which does lend the question, chicken or egg? Did they put the Batman and Robin shots in because they wanted to do this with Batgirl? Or did they do this with Batgirl because they'd already done it with Batman and Robin? You know, it's gratuitous no matter what. And I would argue that if you probably actually measured this down to the frames per second, there's probably a few more frames spent on Alicia Silverstone's rear end than there was on either Clooney's or... See, that's how much of a non-character he is. I've just forgotten who plays Robin.
Chris O'Donnell.
Yeah.
Yet again, like I kind of go back to they're trying to shoehorn so much into this film that they didn't really have the time to kind of flesh out the Batgirl thing properly, you know, and it felt really rushed. And Barbara herself just seemed very laid back about it all. You know, she was pretty cool about everything, and like she kind of just slipped into this Batgirl role very easily.
Yeah, I mean, she unlocks with this terrible password and she sees all these schematics, which Alfred's just left there, of all these bat costumes and bat suits and bat vehicles and all this stuff. I want to say, Alfred's computer's really cool. 20th anniversary Macintosh. I first saw one of those when I first came to London and I'm like, oh, that looks cool. Then I saw the price tag and I'm like, yeah, that still looks cool, but I'm never going to own one. And then... They tried to give us some character development, but again, there's just too much going on. I like the racing thing. I like the fact she's kind of a rebel. You know, she's kind of got a bit of early prototype reboot Lara Croft. There's actually character elements there that came about when they rebooted Tomb Raider, where she's kind of like rebelling against a system. Like, kind of, she doesn't want to be in the rich lifestyle per se. I mean, she was kicked out of Oxford for motorbike racing, apparently. But any kind of like empathy I had towards Barbara was kind of ruined in what I actually genuinely consider to be the worst scene in this movie, which is when she does turn up and she does help save the day. She's there with Batman and Robin and she's just like, Bruce, it's me, Barbara. Yeah. And it's just like, no shit. Because that mask is not disguising anything.
No, say what? Dun, dun, dun. I do like, going back to the racing side, I do like that, I as you said, with the empathy towards her. She's doing this for good reason. There is actually a good storyline there. She's going out and doing these races because she knows that Alfred is ill. And she's trying to then save the money up to save Alfred. But she does say a really weird line to Robin where she goes, I had the money. So why are you going out racing still? There was a bit of a moment when I was sat there going, say what? And I had it on, to break the fourth wall, I had it on 1.5, because I had to, obviously I've got my own stuff to do as well as preparing for this. And I was like, hang on, did she just say she had the money already? And she honestly does. She goes, I had the money already. Well, why did you go racing then? So maybe it is that, you know, what Ash just said, you know, rebelling against the system and that rebooted Tomb Raider, which made me feel a bit more nicer about that line, I've got to admit.
And then she turns up and, like, not only blabs her name, but Batman's real name. And a terrible disguise.
Yes. Bruce, it's me. And just shut up.
Batman.
And that whole line of, like, Batgirl, isn't that a bit non-PC? Shouldn't it be Batperson or Bat? And I'm just like, shut up.
That one's not aged well.
It's like, who knew Batman was also White Knighting?
Yeah. Backgammon.
Okay, so let's just talk about the ending of the film. Let's get this out of the way. So,
yay!
So we see Ivy defeated by Rubber Lips Robin and Freeze turning the telescope into a big freeze gun to freeze Gotham with. And, you know, talk about the whole ending of this film in general. You know, was it a good way to end the film?
No.
Speaking of endings, they had a perfect mid post credit sequence sting, but in these films I always notice that kind of like that twist comes just before the final scene of the film with Freeze and Poison Ivy in Arkham.
I don't get that scene either. Yeah, go on, carry on.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
Why have they given him his whole suit?
Yeah, exactly. If you lift that whole scene out and then place it mid-credits or post-credits, it works so much better because you can you had that disconnect. Like, you can assume, oh, some time's passed since they've been put in Arkham. And this makes sense that Heat Freeze has got his stuff back and he's busting Ivy out to come and rule the world together. I don't know. But it just always struck me as working better out of the narrative of the film. It was just thrown in there.
He's gone in there because this is the whole thing, is he's gone in there because he's obviously understands that she tried to kill his wife, and actually Batman saved her. And that's what I was saying about the whole suit thing, which is hysterical. Like, Gotham Police Force are like, yeah, you can go in there in the whole suit to murder her. Yeah. Which explains why the big statues, really. They haven't got enough money to support both the prison service and the Arkham service and build all those big motherfucking statues. So that means that, you know, that suits, you know, going, a tiny bit of murder, why not?
I see, they're having to get them to share cells. So they can't drop the entire cell temperature down because that would kill Ivy. Yep. And so maybe they just... I mean, traditionally, his suit was powered by jewels, by diamonds. They can't do that either. That's expensive. So I reckon what they've done is they've just kind of run a 13-amp, like, cable in. So he's on an extension lead. And that's also... So it's running in low power mode. It's keeping him kind of, like, cool. But also it means he can never go more than about 15 foot from a power socket.
So damn it, I have to wait another 15 years before contactless charging is created. Damn it.
I just imagine
I'm getting warm. Will you stop using your hair straighteners, for God's sake?
So I can't imagine him just putting extension lead by extension lead by extension lead so he could reach the toilet. But then I was thinking, how the hell does he go to the toilet in that suit? But then let's not go there.
He puts an extension lead there as well.
How does he go to the toilet in general? It would just literally... that's why the icicles are wobbling.
Yeah, it would freeze on its way out.
Oh, that's painful.
It's just like a stream of kidney stones.
A stream of
kidney stones.
They're not diamonds that he actually puts in his suit.
That's how he's pairing the suit from his kidney stones.
They're not actually diamonds that he puts in the suit. They're actually those blue things that you get in urinals.
That is the frosting on the cake.
One of the things I found about this end scene, though, was like they had some scientists and they fell over the edge and they started hanging over the edge quite high up in the end. Batman's like, fuck them. I'm just going to leave them to hang. And I was like, this is not Batman. Batman surely would have saved the people first before he concentrated his attention on the freeze gun, surely, right?
Yeah. I mean, maybe. I think you're putting more thought into this than they did.
Yeah, probably.
Especially seeing that ice that was able to break a statue's neck and freeze people solid now is seem to be melting and keeping those buildings completely intact. While he's a good... Yeah, you think that they thought of, did they want to save those people?
Yeah. How do we think, like, the effects and stuff of freezing Gotham and the people on the ground worked out for it?
They were okay for what they were at the time. Yeah. I do want to give some appreciation that essentially the only way they could portray a frozen Gotham was to actually dress a two-street kind of like they had to just dress the entire set. They couldn't just CGI all of it. So that was a lot of work. And, I know you mentioned about the wobbling icicle earlier. It's still a lot of work to do.
Mm, yeah.
And it looks okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Batman obviously saves the day and stops the gun and Poison Ivy and Freeze end up in prison. And as we've talked about, that Batman and Freeze scene where he gets the cure for Alfred, and, you know, Batman, Robin and Batgirl, they all decide to partner up and be a threesome, and it all ends in a high spirit. And I mean, there's plenty more to dissect on this film, but I mean, we'd all have to check into a mental hospital at some point, I'm sure, if we did.
Arkham Asylum, you could say.
Sweet release.
Are we talking about Mr. Freeze going to the toilet again? Or
But pissing a never-ending stream of kidney stones would be better than discussing this movie any more than we already have.
Watching this back in 2022, was it were we a bit harsh on this film back then, or did they deserve everything they got?
It deserves everything it got. I think there is something to take away from it. As we said earlier, the Gotham set design is beautiful. You know, those statues, obviously the practicality of where the Astronomy Center is or anything like that. You know, that's completely out of the question. But it does look very, very nice. So and there are points that does look nice. And also those flashbacks to the 1960s Batmans, you know, I think fundamentally it is what it is. It's stupid bollocks in a movie, and sometimes stupid bollocks in a movie is all right. Is it good? No. Is it flashy and keeps the child entertained? Probably. Did it sell a lot of toys? Definitely. But no, it's still the worst Batman movie.
I think if this had been made with the specific marketing of we are rebooting Batman 66, it probably would have been viewed a lot more differently. And as it is one of those films. I mean, it's very easy to make fun of Batman and Robin.
Just leave
that's
it.
That's it. That's it. But,
mic drop.
Mic drop, exit stage right. But it has a good cast that don't have a good film to work with. Could Arnold Schwarzenegger have been a better Freeze, a more sinister, a more sympathetic, a less quippy Freeze? Absolutely, with the right director and script. Could George Clooney have been a more interesting and deep Bruce Wayne / Batman? Absolutely, totally. I mean, I say the same of Batfleck. Ben Affleck could have been a way better Batman than he ever got the chance to be. And I'm always sad we never got that standalone film that he wanted to make. And to be honest, I'm kind of the same with George Clooney. I think George Clooney as Batman was a wasted opportunity. Yeah. Alicia Silverstone could have been a better Batgirl. Difficult to tell because the character was, you know, it was there, but not, it had no history. If she'd turned up in Batman Forever and then became Batgirl in Batman and Robin, then we might be having a different conversation on that front. Chris O'Donnell was just there and really didn't care, a waste of an actor. In fact, that's the thing I can say about most of this. It was a waste of the actors involved.
All perfectly capable. And it's the same again what's happening now with DC. Like, they've got these amazing talent, and they're pissing them off. Like, they pissed off Ben Affleck to a point where he's never going to come back. But he was perfect. He looked the part. He was great in it. And then now he's just like, do you know what? You guys go and run your little world. And Henry Cavill's essentially doing the same now.
DC have got the TV series right, although I say that they've just cancelled half of them. Yeah. But I thought the way DC were building the Arrowverse, I actually really dug that. I never watched Arrow, but I really got into The Flash. Yeah. I really, really liked the Flash TV series. I mean, they were the first ones to do King Shark. Kind of like they did it pretty well on a TV budget. And I thought they were doing that great. And I personally would have rather they focused more on that, but no, they wanted that Marvel Cinematic Universe money, and they just did it wrong because they kind of started with the team up and then tried to go off and do the standalone movies because they wanted to play catch up. Back here in the 90s, where we, you know, just to drag us back to Batman and Robin a little bit, Batman was the only real game for most of the 90s. I mean, we had Spawn, we had a few others, but Superman had dug its own grave. By being associated with canon films. And, you know, this film did in part lead to Superman Reborn being shit-canned. It definitely was a contributing factor.
Even to James Cameron's Spider-Man, you could easily say that was the reason why that didn't get the push that it was meant to have had.
But silver lining, and I think more people are realising this, is you kind of had to go scorched earth to get where we got today. We have had a cache of genuinely good Batman films. Even just the first two Nolan films, even just The Dark Knight, really good Batman film. I haven't seen Robert Pattinson's The Batman yet, but I know at least one person who went into it being prepared to absolutely hate it and came out going, wow, they've really actually got Batman. Like, they get who Batman is. And so I'm really excited to see that. And then, of course, we had all the Marvel stuff, which maybe it's gone too far. Maybe we're oversaturated. But we had some great Spider-Man movies. We've still got some great Spider-Man movies. The X-Men, for at least a couple of films, were really good. And then it went Then it went.
Finny
then
Jones.
It went. Yeah, I'm the juggernaut, bitch.
Oh God!
They should have brought Vinnie Jones in as Bane. That would have been amazing.
Yes.
Just instead of just shouting Bane, I'm Bane, bitch.
Monkey business. But no, we had this great renaissance in movies, but it kind of had to end for things to stop. And when the movies did come back, yeah, they were massively commercial. Yeah, there were lots of tie-ins and there were toys. But that first X-Men movie was not a toy exercise. Mm-hmm. That first Raimi Spider-Man movie was not a toy exercise. Yeah, there were toys, mm-hmm. but you didn't have, as with Batman and Robin, the toy makers sat in production meetings influencing design decisions and mm-hmm. taking drawings away so they could have the Batmobile ready to purchase when the film came out. So you kind of had to have this film to get where we got today, whether you like the amount of superhero movies we get today. It is necessary. It's a necessary evil. Yeah. For it to have tanked this much.
Yeah, it kind of woke them up and made the people realise that was not the right journey. It wasn't the right path to go down with these superhero films. Something needed to change.
And we're only seeing in the last 5 years, like, rated R superhero movies, because at that time it was all directed at kids. And mm-hmm. I think the sort of Raimi Spider-Man movies started to push towards, actually, these comics books have been going on for most people's childhoods. They're now in their adult years, and it's only now we're now seeing that they're really trusting R-rated movies to make money. Maybe that will stop after Morpheus, but they are only just starting to do it now. But as Ash said, I think you needed that evil or necessary evil to get to that point.
There was this renaissance in the early mid-2000s or 2010s, wasn't there, where everyone's like, we can reboot things and we can move on and not be stuck in the past. And it's happened with superheroes, it's happened with James Bond, it's happened on TV, it's happened literally everywhere, hasn't it, in the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. There's this, we can do something better with this, and then they move on and they let people go and then try something new, and it turns out to be actually quite decent. Sometimes.
Although I will say, just to correct Cliff, because, you know, not that I like to correct Cliff, but I bloody do. 1997 did have an R-rated superhero movie.
Ooh. Spawn?
Spawn.
Yeah.
Spawn. I mean, it was shit, but it was there.
So what?
We're talking about ever shit CGI. Do you remember Reptile from Mortal Kombat? Just imagine that in every scene. can't go back and watch that movie. Hey.
It had an amazing soundtrack.
It was only be a couple of years, if I'm right, Ash, because you will correct me, because bloody hell, you love correcting me. Isn't it 98 that we saw Blade? Or it must have been 98, 99. So technically we did have another R-rated movie soon afterwards, comic book movie.
I mean, I really do genuinely appreciate how you kind of stepped forward and invalidated your own point.
All right, I'll go now.
But I like what you're talking about with the R-rated films and such. And I think the biggest example of that now is the new Doctor Strange film, which I saw on Friday. And that is as close as I feel like we're getting to a proper... I mean, like, there's an argument out there that this film should be an R-rated film as it is and not a 12A. And, you know, after watching it, I can kind of understand why. I mean, there's some scenes in there that are pretty close to the line.
I did see somebody that me and Ash listened to their podcast post. You think you're moaning about this being a PG? Jaws was a PG. Get over it.
Yeah.
But a couple of facts that I dug up about the Batman and Robin was George Clooney has been known to refund people who saw Batman and Robin. And he called the film a waste of money in later interviews. He called it the biggest break I ever had, though, since it got me into Hollywood, resulting in more successful roles later on. When filming was over, George quipped, "I think we just killed the series." You were right, mate. You were right. And according to John Glover, who played Dr. Jason Woodrue, Joel Schumacher would sit on a crane with a megaphone and yell before each take, "Remember, everyone, this is a cartoon." It was hard to act because that kind of set the tone for the film. Released on the 27th of June 1997 with a budget of $125 million, it managed to pull in $238 million. So Probably didn't make any profit for that.
No, because especially that budget doesn't include marketing, which they went out the wazoo for. I mean, it also doesn't include toy sales. I mean, they sold, but the way this tanked at the box office very quickly, I mean, the drop-off between first weekend and second weekend was immense. And also, 1997, we're in the early days of Ain't It Cool News and similar. And I know Joel Schumacher really had a massive beef against Ain't It Cool News. And I think, was it Dark Horizons, the other website that was big at the time? Yeah, basically just like kind of calling them worthless journalists with no integrity and no kind of like heritage. And on some levels, he has a point. Also, mate, you made a shit movie.
Yeah, and like, and we've said many a times, like, but this year in particular, so heavy in great films, that it didn't really stand a chance at all, did it? So, like you've already said as well, thankfully, in some ways, that it did happen because it was the reset that we needed for greater superhero films further down the line.
And maybe if what I gather of the Patterson movie continues, we might see another pop at Robin.
Oh.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
I saw something today that I don't really consider a spoiler because it's not verbally mentioned in the film and it's actually a scene that appeared in the trailers. But there is a young actor in a scene in The Batman that's already played Robin. He's playing Tim Drake in Teen Titans.
Mm.
And okay. He appears in a scene in The Batman as a gang member that goes up against the Batman, but also who doesn't directly get involved and kind of like hangs back and then runs away. And it's just such an odd thing to put in.
Mm.
Like, it's not mentioned. They don't call him Tim or anything like that. It's just the fact that he's there. And they never even publicized it. It's literally only because the Batman is now available on home video that people are starting to freeze frame through it and see that. And I saw that pop up on my YouTube feed earlier while I was actually looking at like various bits and pieces and some of the music videos to do with Batman and Robin. And that came up and I'm just like, well, that'll be pretty cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's quite exciting, actually. Mm-hmm. And especially if they can pull it off and actually do a decent job of the character. But yeah, we've made it, guys. Well done. We're still alive. So firstly, thank you to Cliff for joining us, mate. Thank you for joining and replacing Rich. I'm sure he's very grateful wherever he's doing. So thank you very much. Do you want to direct the good listeners to where they can find you and what you up to?
So if you want to find me on Twitter or the Instagram, it's N64LifePodcast. On the Twitter as well, for my own personal one, it's The Amazing Cliff. So that's how you do it, Luke, if you listen to this. thank you for that dig on the last podcast, Ash. But no, if you want to go and find me over there, then please do. Obviously, N64LifePodcast is not just a podcast. It is a stream. I found that thing called Twitch. I think I've got it. Maybe, probably. Come and find that on N64 Life Podcast as well. Every Friday and Sunday, when I'm not recording somebody else's podcast, 8:30 till 11.
Beautiful. I mean, I don't really do Twitch streams and everything, but from what I can gather, it's a great piece of fun.
It is.
Lighthearted. It's
created a plush toy with a set of glasses that is sat directly behind me in the way of Jigglychuff. It's not over, but yeah, I've committed to the gimmick. It's there, and if they evolve it any more, then I'm going to throw something at them.
I was going to say, I can't wait for it to evolve into, was it Wigglytuff that it evolves into?
Wigglychuff. Wigglychuff's not happening. Jigglychuff is definitely not over.
Awesome. And Ash, thank you so much for taking some time out to join us to talk about Batman and Robin. It's been a pleasure to podcast with you. Where can people go to find you and your podcast?
I mean, they can find me personally on Twitter, Ash Versus. It's exactly like it sounds, Ashversus. Or you can actually listen to the podcast that the incredulous Chuff ripped off with his N64 life by visiting underconsultation.com. That's console as in video game consultation.
Yep. And as I said at the beginning, it's a great, they're both great podcasts. They're two of my podcasts that as soon as a new release drops into my app, there's the straight away the ones that get played. So guys, well done. Thank you very much for pumping out some top quality entertainment.
Well, Ash does it more frequently than me, so he can take the credit for that one on podcasts anyway.
I pump on a weekly basis.
Well, I pump on video and also do Twitch. But no, yes, all good.
Great.
Go on, promote your OnlyFans.
Please. Please do.
It's Alfred Pennymore.
Well, that's your lot for this one. Thank you, as always, listeners, to everyone for joining us. And if you have enjoyed the pod and would like to support us, then we do have a coffee page where you can give us a one-off tip. Or if you're feeling kinder, a monthly tip starting from £1. A massive thank you to all who have given us a tip. You're all legends. If any of that is not right for you, you can also support us by just giving us a review or rating on Apple, Spotify or Podchaser. You can find links to our coffee page, our entire back catalogue of episodes and much more on our website, which you can find at thewolfypod.com. And you can also hear me and Rich talk video games with Andrew and Steve on Dreamcast Year's podcast. And don't forget that you can find Rich on the Dreamcast Junkyard too. You can find these on Twitter at the Dreamcast Years and the DC Junkyard. Next time, it's part two of our movies of 1997. What will we choose this time? Find out in a couple of weeks' time. Chaps, it's time to say goodbye.
Bye.
Farewell.
Nice to meet you.
And that's why the amazing Cliff does this alone.
My name has been Jason. Dom, it's over to you.
Well, that's it for another episode of What's Wrong with Wolfie. The boys are off now to hit the roulette table with Patricia Routledge. See you later.
What's wrong with Wolfie? I can hear him barking.